got the recording thing going. Okay, good. So, today I want to, well, first off, I have a little bit of awkwardness in this class with the way the tutorials are arranged, because my first instinct is to talk about the tutorials right now, because two of them have finished, but one of them has not. The third one is on Monday. So for those of you who missed a tutorial either Thursday afternoon or Friday morning, you can try squeezing in on Monday. One odd thing, though, is that the Thursday at 4 p.m. tutorial is smaller than the Friday at 8:30 a.m. tutorial. I do not understand this. There should be, and I believe, in fact, there is room in the 4 o'clock tutorial, just say. But I'll tell you as a special treat, those of you who come Friday morning will generally get to see me because I will not be going to the full, I will stop in on the other tutorials, but I will be there for most of the tutorials on Friday morning. So, for those of you who want an incentive to actually wake up in the morning or a disincentive to wake up in the morning, depending on your perspective, but in any case. So, I have now hours decided for the TAs. I'll be putting them up on the wiki and getting it all set up, and they'll start having office hours next week. I'm not anticipating them to get a lot of traffic just yet, but if you're starting to do Code Academy, which is one of the things I suggest for the first tutorial, that you get through a certain part of Code Academy, and you find you're having any difficulties with it, go see a TA. I'm hoping most of you will be able to just go through it and say, oh, I already know this, or it's really easy. But we'll see. For one little tip for those of you who haven't done the tutorial, if you're going to go through the two directions, make sure you know which copy of the code you have. If you follow the directions, it's possible to have one copy of the Hello World and a second copy of the Hello World, and you'll edit one part of it, and then you'll go and you run the other one. You'll go like, why can't I see my changes? It's because you changed the wrong version. So if you decide to, there are two versions of the Hello World. If you do one and you decide to switch the other one, delete the old files and do the other one. It'll save you a lot of grief. It's the only tip I'll give. Any questions that are on your mind? Otherwise, I'm going to start talking about history. So starting next week, I'm going to start explaining Node in more detail. I'm going to start talking about the actual stack of technologies we're going to be using throughout the class and the idiosyncrasies of JavaScript. But I want to wait until after you all have actually experienced it a little bit. It'll make things a little more concrete. But before talking about that, I want you all to contemplate a world without, or more specifically, before the web. So there is the internet, and there is the web. So when did the web start? When is really kind of the beginning of the web? Is anyone at the year? It's basically early 90s, 91, 92, I think 91 was when Tim Berners-Lee was putting together things, but early 90s. When did the internet start? Late 60s. Like the major papers describing the internet are all from like the late 60s, early 70s, like 1972 are some really good ones. I mean, but that was just right. So late 60s is when you talk about the foundations of the internet, early 90s, the web. What'd you do for all those decades in between? You weren't on Facebook. What was the internet for? What'd you do with it?
Looking up things from Harvard.
Looking up things from Harvard? Well, Harvard was certainly on the internet, as were lots of other major universities and things, but you didn't have a web browser. You didn't use that at all. What did you use? So I have some of them up here if you're looking around. So the kind of things you would use, the kind of protocols you'd use, are things like Telnet. So Telnet, for those of you who don't know, is
Well, you've all used SSH to connect the SES servers, right? Basically, you've all seen now terminal windows. Telnet was a way to just connect to a remote server. Now, but the fun thing about the Telnet protocol is it just sends everything in the clear. It's just you type in things and it just goes to remote systems. So you want to type in your password, it's just a string of characters going across the internet for you to watch. So Telnet still works today, but I wouldn't recommend you using it. But so what does Telnet let you do? It lets you access typically a shell prompt on a remote machine. So now you're at a command line. I know some of you actually are really fond of command lines, and others of you really don't like them. But as Neil Stephenson said, in the beginning was the command line. You are familiar with that? Oh, no, you're probably not. I'll just show that for you in case you're curious. What is the command line? It's worth reading. For those of you who don't know Neil Stephenson, he's famous cyberpunk author who decided to not be so cyber or punk, but more historical fiction and his more recent stuff. But Snow Crash is one of his more well-known works, but he's got lots of good books. Anyway, he's got a nice little rant here about operating systems, which is a bit dated, but still surprisingly accurate. Anyway, the reason, so I mentioned that because there are command lines. And so a lot of the tools were for doing command line access. So you've got, you know, Telnet was one way of doing this. This was used for connecting to faraway systems typically, because you generally have to type in your password every time. Or you could use remote shell. Use RSH. You might want to wonder, where does the name SSH come from? It comes from RSH, because it's a secure version of RSH. So remote shell just lets you connect, and again, it would ask you for the password, but if you were coming from the right IP address, the right host or something, it would just let you in if you were the right user. Again, not particularly secure, but very useful for talking to lots of computers in a, you know, in your, you know, say, university's network. Okay, this lets you type at the command line. What else could you do? How about send email? Simple mail transport protocol is old. It goes back. And in fact, SMTP is not the first version of email. But anytime you send email, it's being sent by this protocol. It starts with hello, such and such. And it says data. It's a very chatty protocol. You can actually sit there and tell that to a mail server and type in SMTP and send an email message. Of course, nowadays you really can't so much because of spam protections. Most email servers are more choosy now in who they talk to. But so, early internet, you talk to a command line. You could send email. You could transfer files. So RSH actually had a variant where you could RCP and you could copy files from one system to another, again, that were trusted. Or, of course, there's good old FTP. In FTP, you would log into another server and you'd say, I want to send a file. And it would give you a command line prompt. And you would say, upload this file, download this file. How many of you have used FTP? Because it's still kind of around. If you've ever maintained a website, a lot of times they still have FTP, which is really dumb because FTP is a very insecure protocol. Your passwords go in the clear over the internet. So a lot of times they won't actually be FTP, it'll be SFTP, which is actually based on SSH, which is a nice cryptographic protocol, but a lot of times you still upload to your website using FTP. Avoid it if you can. But FTP is interesting more than the fact that it's insecure, because it wasn't always used just for you sending files for yourself or amongst a trusted group of individuals. It was also used as a generalized file distribution mechanism for whoever wanted to grab things. In particular, there is anonymous FTP. Now, some of you, I'm sure, have used anonymous FTP, whether you or not you knew it, because web browsers, in fact, will do FTP sometimes in the background. It's one of the protocols they support. How many of you have logged in to an anonymous FTP server by typing in anonymous? Not many people. So when I say you log into an anonymous FTP server and you type in anonymous, it's because it asks for a username and password. But you had to type in a username and password when you basically weren't anyone. So you would literally type anonymous. And then for your password, it would say, well, please type in your email address. And they'd want you to type in your email address to identify you so they know who accessed the server. And then you'd be there and you could look around at a file repository. Typically, you'd be given read-only access, but you could browse the files. Any files you want, you could grab. So, seems a little more interesting now. Now, you know, really, for first approximation, this is what we do with the web. We go out there and we browse the web, which really means grabbing files, transferring those files to your local machine, and doing stuff with them. That's what anonymous FTP was. Except it was with a command line interface, text only, and the only way to get the files, you'd say get, and you'd give the name of the file, and it would be downloaded to your system. Now, there were various file types in these things. Sometimes you could get text files, you could get images, you could get, you know, tarballs or zip files, you know, basically, you know, archives or other things, typically for source code or other things. But anything, someone who might be on the internet, you could find, you know, that they might be interested in, you could find an anonymous FTP site. So it was a very useful resource. I remember when basically in the early 90s, I was doing anonymous FTPs in order to get research papers. Because there'd be repositories, there were certain places that had a repository of research papers, and you'd look through them and you'd grab the file that listed all the research papers and gave the file names, and then you'd go through it and you'd find the file name you're interested in, and then you'd retrieve that file. I think the well, I'm not sure, it might have had a Telnet interface. I'm not sure. Well probably had a couple of interfaces because they're kind of a news group kind of thing. So there's also, so in addition to SMTP, which is designed for one-to-one email, there was a network news transfer protocol. NNTP looks kind of like email, except that it's for discussion groups. But the discussion groups are kind of weird because they're not centralized. There's no one system you go to read the entire discussion group. Instead, it's decentralized, and every NNTP server would kind of send its latest articles to all the other ones. So it was this peer-to-peer network where everything was essentially mirrored everywhere else. And so you might have heard, and there had various hierarchies of articles. So like, I think there would be a one under rec something for discussions of various TV shows or for discussions of various, you know, research areas or whatever anyone wanted to talk about. This was before Reddit, before Slashdot, there was NetNews. And it would, now the problem with NetNews is that you can still use it now, and it's kind of useful if you want to get various not so legal content, but it's kind of too large for most people to filter. But this is Usenet.
Okay, how old is Usenet and IRC anyway?
Yeah. Much older. IRC is from the 80s, NNTP is from the 80s, maybe dating from the late 70s. Yeah, I can tell you right here. So NNTP, RFC, okay, yeah, 86 is NNTP, and IRC, so for those of you who want to talk in real time with each other instead of just send, you know, IRC's history is, it goes, so what is the history of it? In 88. So late 80s. Yeah, these are all, actually IRC is kind of late. 88. So the 80s, these were all being built. So you could chat with people using IRC. Because, you know, that's kind of real-time chat with, you know, with different people. You could distribute news, you could transfer files, you could send email, could access remote systems. But you couldn't do a lot of this stuff easily. In particular, accessing remote information meant downloading files to your local system and then accessing them. Very primitive, very annoying interface. So people in the early 90s and late 80s basically said, oh, let me start trying to do certain things. So they came things like Gopher. People heard of Gopher? You can still find Gopher servers around. But the idea of Gopher, so let's see, so that's stagnation. Origin, oh, at least in late spring of 1991. Okay, so think the web, but a text-only interface with menus. So like you get this list of menus and say you want 1, 2, 3, 4, this is what you want. You go down the hierarchy and you get information you want. And when you navigate the hierarchical menu, you'd say, oh, that's exactly what I want. And it would show you that information of text. And Waze is kind of similar. Where is Waze here? They use ANSI standard, it's a little fancier for some. So if you look through these articles, you can kind of see the competition between them. But what I'm trying to point out here is that the internet existed long before the web. People did useful things on the internet. And when the web arose, there were other competitors. There were other things that came along and were trying to do the same kind of thing of allowing easy access to information on remote servers. Giving it more user-friendly. But we got stuck with the web. So anyone know why the web was considered to be better than these other systems? What was the killer feature? What really made the people think this was exciting?
It was easy,
but what do you mean? I mean, there was text menus and there was, you could navigate through it. What's not easy about a menu? Okay, so this GUI mouse thing, I think, is definitely part of it. But remember, initially, this was definitely a geeky group. These were people who were very computer savvy. They were the only ones who used tools like IRC and anonymous FTP and even email. No, all these the Gopher protocol and other things used URLs like that were using the DNS as a way of just identifying computers. DNS was there. Again, that was there for a long time, and that formed the infrastructure for all those other protocols too. So the key thing, mosaic. No, that's not that mosaic. That wrong mosaic. Mosaic. Come on, science software. Web browser, there we go. Bigger. That's Mosaic. Kind of funny to have a browser in a browser. So this looks basically kind of what you are used to, just a bit more primitive. But you got to contrast this with. That's why I do a search for Gopher. Yeah, no, I thought the Gopher. Okay, fine. If I go to images, I'll get pictures of gophers. I was wondering if I'd show a screen capture of it. But the key thing I want to say is that, you see, this was a GUI application. The fact that it was a GUI, in particular, the web supported images. It supported bold-faced text. It supported primitive kinds of page layout. That was the key difference. Most Waze and Gopher and stuff didn't really give you much flexibility in how you presented the information. The web, you could build pages. And you could build pages pretty easily.
Was it HTML?
I'll talk about the technology, but I'm saying, but what was the underlying system was, it was, you have this web browser, and this web browser would take content, and so notice, what does it mean to show images in a page? You know, all the other technologies before were all about showing individual files. The web's advantage was that the browser would take multiple files and use those multiple files and put them together into a single rendering of information. It could aggregate them, and it could aggregate them in some sort of aesthetically pleasing ways, or at least some, certainly more usable than the things beforehand. And so that's, so to understand web servers and understand what we're talking about by web technology, it's good to look at that first step and understand why was it interesting. And that was it. I mean, we had the fact that you can transfer files over HTTP, that you can navigate information over HTTP, that you do all these, this is all stuff that people did before. The fact that you communicate with people over HTTP. So many of these use cases were already done. What we've had now is all of these things which were in different protocols, in different client applications, are now all getting shoehorned into this thing we call a web browser. And the web browser can do it because, so again, it allowed this kind of aggregation. And that ability to aggregate information, aggregate files together, has only grown over time. And that, in fact, is the complexity of web technology, is that you're bringing all these separate bits from different sources and trying to make something coherent out of it, and keeping track of what all those different sources are, what the technologies are behind those different sources, and then dealing with all the seams where they don't quite match. That's what makes the web hard. That's also what makes the web worth doing. So, what was Mosaic? So, by the way, Mosaic was not the first web browser.
I don't remember its name. What if it actually tells me? History of the web browser. There we go. Okay, Ted Nelson. So Ted Nelson, so you should. Ah, there we go. First web browser. No, that's not. Yeah, there it is. This is the first web browser. So does anyone know the operating system behind this? So the operating system that this is running is something called NextStep. Are any of you running variants of NextStep right now? What? Mac OS X is NextStep. Mac OS X is NextStep with a different skin and lots of new technologies on top of it, but it's still NextStep. And in fact, if you ever program Mac OS, or if you program iOS, you'll notice a lot of the objects have a prefix of NS. NS stands for NextStep. Still in the object descriptions. So this was the first web browser. Of course, it was on NextStep. There weren't that many Next workstations. There were these cool things that were started by, where is it? Oh, that's not what I wanted. There we go. This thing, that was a Next workstation. You know, a guy named Steve Jobs? This was the company, these are the kind of computers he had went and made after he got kicked out of Apple. He got kicked out of Apple, he founded Next Corporation. They built computers for a while. Next wasn't doing well financially. Apple was doing really badly financially. Apple acquired Next, which meant Next took over Apple. Steve Jobs took over back over Apple and then. So when you're using Mac OS, you are using a true machine for browsing the web. But when we talk about the web,
We talk about what was the innovations with the technology. What has allowed this sort of aggregation? It's certain very simple ideas.
And the simple ideas came from, in part, separating the protocol from the presentation. So the protocol for communicating with the server and asking for information was this protocol known as HTTP. Hypertext Transfer Protocol. And the protocol for showing the information is HTML. As we talked about last time. Now, both of these were relatively simple in the beginning. Today, HTTP is still relatively simple. HTML, not so much. Because it's been extended as people want to do more and more things with it. And then there's all the other technologies that go along with it. But this remains simple. And they've made some improvements, and their alternatives saying they're there for improving performance. But this stayed simple. Now the question is, why did it stay simple? Why did this have to blow up in complexity while HTTP could stay simple? Now, when I say simple, there's really only two commands that you give most of the time with HTTP. You do gets. I mean, there are other ones, but there are gets and there are posts. And the basic language is you give get and you give it a URL. So I don't think you actually include the HTTP in it, but you just say like you say the web page you want to get, and you say, yeah, give it to me. And post says, I got the same thing you give a URL, but instead of just getting something from the server, you actually upload something to the server and then expect a response back. Gets are for getting pages. Posts are to send something to the server, to send new information to the server. That's it, really. That's basically all in general you're doing with HTTP is getting or sending information to the server. But if this is so simple, what this really means is this is a file transfer protocol and a data sending protocol. What do you do here? You take these and use them to retrieve a file and make a page. But now, how many of these do you do when you view a typical page? One? Okay, we got one. Dozens to hundreds nowadays. The reason why you do so many is because each separate part of the web page is retrieved separately through separate get requests. Every little image that is incorporated is a separate GET request. You're going to have a little box there that's going to be a search box from Facebook. That's going to be a search box from Google. That's going to be a separate GET request to get the code for that. There's going to be multiple bits of code for the headers and stuff. There's going to be style sheets. Those have to be gotten separately. As we're going to be looking at web pages, we're going to show you all the tools for how to debug web pages, watch how they work and stuff. You're going to see that the complexity of what happens is insane. But the insanity is that of accumulation. Every little piece of it is not that complicated. It's just that you're doing so much of it. And that's because this HTML page is a container. It's best not even to think of it as a thing for specifying layout and stuff. It's really more of a container for taking a whole bunch of different things and aggregating them together and putting them in different places. So,
what's the classic way now you divide up a page
is a div tag. So HTML
is always with these tags, with brackets, where one
tag starts it, and the same one
closes it. So you'll see a lot of these div tags in pages. But the div tag is kind of a funny thing, because all it really does is it denotes separation. It's giving a partitioning of the page. It doesn't say what it's supposed to look like. Now, this is a contrast to how pages used to be built. You used to really spend more time with building tables. And so tables would have their own form, or you'd specify how things look specifically. Like you'd say B for bold, or I for italics. You'd give lots of different attributes for different parts, but now you typically don't do that nearly so much. What you instead do is divide your page up into a bunch of divs. So what determines what they look like? Style sheets. In other words, CSS. So what you will do is divide up your document typically into divs or other regions, and you give them names. And then you make a separate file that tells how those are all supposed to look. See, now we've abstracted. So one thing has been abstracted away from the page. Before, the HTML tried to do everything. Now we say, well, it's just going to denote the structure, and the styling of it will be delegated to another technology, which is separate from it, in particular, CSS. CSS can be put in line in a page, but it's more typically put in a separate file. See, this is the aggregation. But the aggregation happens by specialization. You have different jobs. So every time you see a new technology or a different kind of acronym, you have to ask, what is its role in creating a document or creating an application? Once you understand its role, you'll understand what it can do and what it can't do. So I want to stick an image in here. So there's IMG tags. And there, in an IMG tag, I can specify an image. And then that image will be in a file. And that file will be loaded separately. So you get things like JPEGs or PNGs or whatever. They will be incorporated. Now, what if you want to make the page change? What if you want to not have the page be the same all the time? You need some way of specifying how that page should dynamically change. Now, there are earlier efforts, things like dynamic HTML. They tried adding some things into the language to make it a little more dynamic, you know, or a little less boring. One of the most annoying examples of this was the blink tag. It knows what the blink tag, right? The blink tag, you can make text blink. Go on, off. When you see pages with the blink tag, you know you're viewing old web pages. But the blink tag, very annoying. But now you can get the same effects. But to get those same effects, you're going to have to do typically a little more work. You're going to need something that will tell it to change the style dynamically. And thus, you will need code. And the code you will use is JavaScript, which we'll be focusing a lot this term. But again, note that JavaScript does not stand alone. JavaScript is a programming language that is designed to fit into the container that is HTML. It is supposed to work in the context of HTML and everything else that comes with it. It's supposed to work with the CSS. It's supposed to work with the images. It's supposed to be able to manipulate all that and provide the logic for all these entities. So this is a different thing from most other programming environments in which you've worked. In most other environments, what is primary, what is the main thing, is your code. And your code determines how everything else is structured, how everything else works. That's not the case on the web, not on the client side. What determines how everything fits together is the HTML of the page. It is the framework. It provides the core data, and the everything else hangs off of it, including the code. The code fits in there, and that has very significant consequences about how JavaScript is structured, because it's in effect not in charge of all of its data, or even its context. It's put into an environment and said, go figure it out. But okay, I've got code here. Any kind of programming language you've got, I'm saying that now the web page and everything in it is data for the programming language. You got these stupid angle bracket things all nested in everything. It's like, if I'm going to program this, does this mean I have to parse all that text? Does that have to go through and find where all the tags are and figure out what's nested and positions and stuff like that? Well, you can, in principle, do that, but in general, you don't want to do that because it's a very painful way of programming. So what do you do instead?
You wait for the web browser to do the hard work for you. You don't parse your data structures in JavaScript. You let someone else do it, the browser. And the browser thus gives you all those data structures pre-digested. It transforms the entire web page into a bunch of data structures that you can manipulate. So in some sense, that makes the life of JavaScript easier. You don't have to do any parsing. But that, at least not initially. Anyone know the name of that data structure?
Yep.
Document Object Model, the DOM.
So if you look at the literature on the web, and you look at criticisms of things, in particular criticisms of JavaScript, there are some of those criticisms which are definitely about JavaScript. As I said, JavaScript is the first draft of a great programming language, but it's the first draft and there's lots of glitches. And when you part of programming JavaScript is learning how to work around those glitches. But the other thing that people really get upset about is not JavaScript's fault, because JavaScript doesn't control it. It's the DOM. It's this stupid data structure that you have to interact with. And you have a choice of not interacting with data structure? No. You're just plucked in there. You're in a web page. That's your environment. You got to manipulate it. And the problem with the DOM, first off, is it's complex. There's lots of details in it, and it's not always the same. When you're talking about browser compatibility, why is there weird things that happen from one browser to another? It's not typically with JavaScript. I mean, there are some little differences in the language implementations and things, but JavaScript is not a complex language. It's not that hard to get most of it right and to deal with the bugs. This is complicated because this document object model is a data structure that represents everything. It's got all the HTML in it. It's got all the CSS in it. It's got references to the other JavaScript. It's got references to the images. It's got everything incorporated into your page is somewhere in the DOM. And the DOM is the data structure that's used to render the page, to make everything fit together. If it turns out how it parses it is slightly different from one browser to the next, your pages are going to look different. And this is what drives web designers mad. The slight differences in how this is all put together. I'm just saying it's not JavaScript's fault. It's the fact that you have a DOM. I think it's inevitable in how we've built the web, that because the web evolved over time through the aggregation of multiple technologies, each of which is supposed to fulfill a specific role, and then you have this thing called the web browser, which is supposed to aggregate all these things together, that aggregation is going to be a little iffy. You can get it mostly right, but the little bits are going to be not quite right. That's where your pain's going to be. So we've got
JavaScript now and HTML, we've got CSS and stuff. He's like, is this all a fixed landscape? Not at all. The history of the web is new technologies being added to this, to this framework of HTML, new things being put into there. Anything like, for example, there's now coming along the video tag. Because before, the web did not have so much native support for video. Actually, the web had support for video from very early on. It was just really bad codecs. And so the video looked really bad, or it was really way too large to download, and so you didn't have good video support. And so what came into there was browser plugins. So a browser plugin, in the context of what we're talking about, it's saying, oh, you've got HTML, it's a container for lots of different things, let me extend the browser with some additional code and make a new kind of container where something gets stuck in there. Originally it was Java, and you would have Java applets, which means, okay, this part of the page is now running Java. It doesn't know about the rest of the page, it knows nothing about the DOM. So it can't do anything outside of its box, but it has a little box in which to do everything. So as long as your browser has that Java plugin, it can handle the Java applets that are inserted into pages. Same thing for Flash. Same thing for Silverlight. So all these different plugins, they're saying, let me have my own little part of a web page where I can do my work. But it's no longer really part of your DOM then. It's living in its own universe. And the trend of the web is to take all these technologies and to try to incorporate them into the DOM, into a way it can be manipulated by JavaScript, because then it's all one thing that you can work with. And also that means that's something that's typically standardized, where all these little extensions are proprietary. So video started taking off when YouTube started using Flash to send video. But Flash was a plugin, Flash wasn't everywhere, Flash worked really badly on mobile, and now people are trying to make it so that there's just a separate tag for video. And the idea that's that now can be under the control of JavaScript. So like everything else. You want to do some sort of real-time chat? You want to do video chat? There's now a protocol coming along, WebRTC, for doing video chat inside of the browser. Again, instead of it just being a container which will be dumb, this will be another part of the DOM, which will add new capabilities which will be able to be manipulated by JavaScript. So instead of having a plugin like Skype or a standalone program, this will be part of your browser. So the web is not at all fixed. The technologies keep changing, they keep getting added, but the core has remained remarkably consistent. We have this HTML stuff, and then we have all these things added on top of it, built with HTTP. So how hard is it to build a web browser nowadays? From scratch? Is it, a couple of weeks, couple of months, couple of years? How difficult is this, as a task, to make a fully functional web browser? It's as difficult as an operating system. I would say it's probably more difficult than most operating systems, at least the simple ones. To give you an idea, the key part of any web browser is the rendering engine. There are lots of different kind of okay rendering engines, but there's really not many rendering engines that can implement, that can have you view the full web, and have you view most of the pages that you're used to viewing. The ones that exist now, there's Trident, Gecko, Blink, and WebKit. Blink is a recent, I think it's Blink, it's a recent form of WebKit by Google. WebKit was pioneered actually by Apple, WebKit came from a project called KHTML, but then Apple forked it and made WebKit, and then HTML is basically dead, and we have WebKit. Blink is now a fork of it. Gecko was a renderer for Firefox. This is the renderer for Chrome. WebKit's a renderer for Safari and for lots of other browsers. It's very easy to bet. Trident is a renderer for Internet Explorer. That's it. Opera had one, and they bailed just last year. They had their own renderer, and I forget the name of this renderer, but anyway, Opera had its own, and they decided they couldn't keep up. And so they got rid of it, and they adopted WebKit. If you're using a mobile device, you're probably using WebKit. Unless you're on Windows Phone, then you're using Trident, or unless you've downloaded Firefox and Android, and then you're using Gecko. Part of the rules of Apple's ecosystem is that you may not have your own rendering engine. So you know how there's a bunch of web browsers on iOS, some of you might know? All those use Safari underneath. It's all using WebKit. They're not allowed to implement these other things for various security-based and competitive reasons. Yes? So it's kind of funny. First, Android has a couple of browsers. There's a standard Android browser, and that was clearly WebKit based. And then Chrome, as kind of from the desktop, has moved to Android, moved to the phone, and that's a separate code base, which was originally WebKit, but it was Chrome's own variant of WebKit, and they changed it so much that they forked it, and now it's Blink. And so newer builds of Android are more kind of this more Chrome-ish thing, but the older ones are more standard WebKit, which is close to what Safari is. And the thing about WebKit's a little bit funny as a thing because there's so many conditional compiles, you can actually get many different kinds of behavior out of one engine. But I'm just listening to this to make you realize the web is so complex and there's so many details and parts of things, people have only implemented it a few times, and these are the ones that are being actively developed. And if you're not part of this, and notice none of these is new. I mean, all of these go back over a decade, if not more, in their codebase. And this is the thing about big programs. They are not designed. I will tell you today, if you were to sit down and try to design a program that could parse the modern web, you'd fail. Sit down and design it, you'd code it, and you'd find it didn't work. And then you would spend months to years updating it to try to get it to deal with all the corner cases. Because the standards are not enough. So this is all really a way of saying, when you're building web apps, you're building applications where part of the runtime is targeting these engines. These engines are crazy complex, and they're different. And there's different versions of them. You will have pain trying to get your application running correctly in all of them, consistently. There are tools to help make this task easier, but by writing a web application, you're writing a cross-platform program by default from the get-go. And the cross-platforms, these are your platforms. Okay, so that's the client side. What's going on the server side? What happened with web technologies there? So anyone know what web servers first look like? You should kind of have an idea based on what I was describing, right? Early web servers look like FTP servers. They serve files. You'll note what you're using in this class can be considered a web server, but it
It's not designed to serve files. It's a program runtime. It's a JavaScript interpreter. So, when we say web server, the early ones, it's all about files. But the modern ones, they run code. You might say, well, if one runs code and files, shouldn't the server have to change radically? Well, yes. Well, why doesn't HTTP have to change radically? No. HTTP is still just sending files. It's just the files are being dynamically generated. They're being created on the fly as needed for certain specific purposes. So how do you get from here to here painfully? If you look at how web servers are, so if all of you know things like Apache,
that's kind of one of the biggest ones.
Now, Apache is an old web server. Its code base in parts dates to the very first web servers, the ones coming out of NCSA. And in fact, do you know what the name Apache comes from? No, it's not from the helicopter. It is, Apache is, yeah, Native American, Aboriginal in the U.S. No, that's not where the name comes from. It's actually kind of a pun.
It's like Apache server.
Yes, it's Apache server. As in, it's a set of patches to the NCSA web server. In other words, it started off as a hack and kept going. This is the web. Embrace. So Apache was a web server that was designed for serving files. It's saying when you ask for a specific path, a URL, it was saying, what's a URL? It's a host name plus something afterwards. You use these all the time. You see them all the time. Here. But you notice here, what does this URL look like? You see it's www.google.ca. Well, here's the protocol description, HTTPS. Then you have the host name, w.google.ca, and then you have this. Is that a file name? No, it is not a file name at all. The only thing that looks at all file-like is the first bit, search. But like you go to my website, but if I go to my wiki, that's not so good, but if I go to so here's my home page. These are files. This is old. So if I go here to my publications, it's a file. See, //publications.html. That's a file in my directory. And this is pointing to files. You want to pull up a PDF? Oh, look, we got this. Oh, this is a PDF. It builds a built-in renderer for the PDF. And by the way, this renderer in the newer versions of JavaScript, PDF render, the newer forms, newer versions of Firefox, is written in JavaScript. There, that's what I was trying to say. This is a JavaScript program here that's rendering the PDF. So this is files, files, files. But then I have these weird links. Like I have this link here to my Withings, and that's going to this, which is going to my wiki. Is this files? No. This is not files. This is code. This is code running an application called MediaWiki, which was developed by Wikipedia. Their code, that's what this is. It's just my own instance of it. So that's what typical modern web servers look like, is you've got this transition from the world of files to this world of code. And in the case of something, and I would say what we're going to really see in this class is you see it's going away from just being files and more towards being code. And you have these giant strings. But so if you've got a web server that runs code, and also designed to deal with files, how do you combine those that functionality? Straightforward way is you start, well, the evolutionary way of doing it is you start off with files, so this dealt with files, and then you need to start running code. You add a plugin or add a module. You add some bit of some sort of extension to this that does whatever else you want. And in fact, that's the way it's been done for a long time, up until much more recently. And the extension, for example, for this is like, want to run PHP? There's an extension to Apache. But that's not how we did it originally. The first code in a web server was more commonly written in a language called Perl. Anyone here packed on Perl? Perl? A couple. Perl's kind of old and out of fashion now, but it's still there. Hasn't really gone away. But the way Perl would hook into this was that the web server would run as one process, and it would run Perl each time it got a request for a dynamic web page. For a page that you had to run code to generate it, it would start up Perl and say, here's Perl, here is what I want to get, and it would sit there and run for a while, it would make up a page, and then it would send it back to the web server, and the web server would send that off to the client. The interface it would use is something called CGI, Common Gateway Interface. Yes? Yes? Yeah, well, so the extensions you can see .php and things like that, but modern websites, that'll be hidden. That way, nowadays you don't see that. Like, for example, I can tell you my wiki. Where'd my mouse go? There it is. So my website, this is written in PHP, and so you see this index.php? So that's how you can tell it's PHP, but I can easily change the configuration so that doesn't show. And in fact, a lot of modern web applications, you won't see that. And for example, all the applications you'll write with Node, they will not have a specific thing for let you identify what the language is, because there is no file extension. And well, the key thing to ask is, why is that PHP there? Why is that particular code? That is there for Apache's benefit, not for PHP's. Because this is all about, that is the scene. This is the file that is being given to the PHP interpreter. Saying, PHP, here, run this code. And it does that, and then it gives the answer, which is actually very similar to how Perl does it. The main difference is PHP is running all the time. The Common Gateway Interface is very useful for running a separate program that gets run every time, but if you don't want to start up a program every request you get in, and like if you're getting thousands of requests a second, starting a program for each request is really wasteful. You want the program just to sit there and interpret things as they come in, you keep it running, you add it as an extension that's as part of the Apache program. It's actually loaded into that program, is incorporated into it. Now that's good for efficiency, but that means if PHP messes up, it can actually crash the web server. This is a problem for Apache Ring Stable, is that all this code that gets stuck into it can mess it up, but then it's right there for handling these requests as they come. But the front end, the main thing dealing with everything is files. And Apache only invokes PHP when it gets files that have the right extension. But then what if everything is code? What if most of your stuff is code? This is really kind of bizarre. Why are we going through this thing that wants to serve files and then loading individual files, interpreting them, and then sending them off to an interpreter? Why do we need all that overhead? And that, in fact, is what I love about systems like Node. There is no Apache. There is no server there for just serving files. There is just the part for running code. And that code, if you have a file you need to send to the client, you can just load the file and send it on.
And as you'll see, doing standard file services, so like Node is actually really simple. But most systems that you'll see deployed are based around an architecture where there is something that is designed to serve the files, and it is extended in some way to allow you to run code. Evolution in action. So what's the right technology for running a website? So I can talk about Node and stuff, but as I mentioned before, there's all these different technologies. It's complete chaos. I mean, you know, things like Ruby, there's languages, there's Ruby, Python. You have to choose the language in which you're going to make stuff. .NET. And then once you've chosen your language, you have to choose your framework. You know, for Java, there's JSP, there's like Vert X, Python, it's Django, which I'm not sure exactly how to spell it. Is it just JN? No. It's DJ, yeah. Django, okay, it is. Ruby, there's Rails. Now, when I say these frameworks, I'm saying that these are just programming languages. And then when you have a programming language, you have to decide, how am I going to implement web server-like things? What technology am I going to use to generate the pages? Well, different people have taken the same language and coded different ways of generating web pages. Different frameworks. And some of them are more fun than others. Some of them are better than others. The fact is if you're in the real world and you're working at a company, you most of the time don't get to make this choice. Because what you're going to be doing is modifying a web application they already have. And so you'll be just have to learn whatever technology here that is. You'll have to figure it out and make your changes. So, given this plethora of options, as an educator, it's easy to despair. Because there is no way I am teaching you about all of these frameworks. It's impossible. It's just, if I were to spend your entire undergraduate career trying to teach you about the different frameworks, I probably wouldn't cover them all. There's so many of them. And not only are there so many of them, they have a lot of real differences in how they do things. So I can't teach you all of them. But this course isn't called web applications, it's called fundamentals of web applications. So I have to choose what's the fundamental thing. So in not covering these sort of things, I'm not saying they're bad. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with them, although some of them I certainly have preferences about which seems more interesting to me than others. But really, the number of different web, programming languages, the number of web frameworks is as varied as every programmer. And what it comes down to, the different frameworks are all about how do you conceptualize the problem of building a web application. And it depends on what the web application is for you. What do you want it to do? And what we'll be covering in this class is Node.js. So Node.js is really just JavaScript, but running on the server. And the framework that we're using for it is something called Express. Express, I don't know if, that's getting below the board. Some of you can't see that, sorry. Where can you see? Up to where? What? Hmm? You can see .NET. Okay. So I'll just write.
And then what we have is Express. This is server-side.
It's just JavaScript running in the server instead of running in the web browser. So the language is the same. The engine is the same. But what's different about the runtime? There's one key thing that you have in the browser that you do not have on the server when you run JavaScript. The DOM. The DOM is gone. There is no DOM. Because there is no one page. You're serving multiple pages. So you're running JavaScript here, but there's no DOM. So any of the interactions with the DOM and everything, that all goes away. And in fact, that leaves, what do you actually do instead? Well, Node.js said, well, here is a bunch of thing libraries and interface and stuff for doing more classic operating system things. Like, how do I access local files? How do I open a network socket? Other things. That's what they extended the JavaScript language with when they made Node.js. But then on top of that, now you still have to build your web framework. How are you going to abstract this? And we're using this framework called Express. There are other ones for Node. And in fact, if you look at the Express framework, you'll see it's built on a whole bunch of other technologies. And if you want to see how deep this goes, one nice thing about Node is you can see exactly how deep this goes. Because you just go into this directory called Node modules. And in that directory, you'll find all the code that your application depends upon. You have to run this command, as you'll see, called npm to populate this. But then once you do, you have all this code. Now, inside that, you'll see that, there's this package and this package. And if you look inside of those, you'll see further subdirectories. And inside those, you'll see further subdirectories. This directory tree inside of this is like 4 or 5 levels deep. Because you have packages that depend upon packages that depend upon packages that depend upon packages. And you can see exactly how things are put together to give you the web functionality you want. It's pretty complicated. But the interface is relatively straightforward. So, why this stack? Couple of reasons. One is, I have to teach you JavaScript anyway. You don't understand the browser until you understand JavaScript. So this way I'm only teaching you one language. I'm not saying that all of you should definitely create applications in JavaScript on the server side. I think Node is actually a pretty nice platform. It's got some nice things, but no. But it is very modern. It has some nice features there. One language to cover. The other reason why I like Node is because it's particularly well suited for learning about asynchronous design. And I think that's what I'm going to talk about, the last thing I'm going to explain today. So if you're the key challenge of building a high-performance web server is the issue of concurrency. And I mean by the issue of concurrency is, say, if you're a busy website, you've got many requests coming in per second. Hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, but you've got all these requests coming in. The requests will come in at a high rate. They're coming at a high enough rate that you may not be able to finish with one request before the next request comes. So you have to constantly be able to accept these requests even while you're busy computing, doing computation, doing I/O for other requests. So what structure do you have for this? So the classic Unix way of dealing with this sort of concurrency in requests is that a request would lead to a process. So some of you, a lot of you haven't had operating systems, so the The idea of a process may or may not be clear, but when I say a process, I'm just saying an instance of a running program. It means you ran the program, when you run the program, it's gonna, you get a process. It's got its own memory, it's got its own CPU allocation, it's busy running. And the idea is, when you, with older designs, you say each request that comes in, so one request, one process. Now, this is a very clean design because if you have 20 requests coming in, you start up a process for each of them, and whenever each finishes, it's fine. And the main process sits there, and all, its only job is to wait for incoming requests. Every time a new request comes in, it just says, oh, here's another process. You handle that request. I'm going to wait for the next one to come in. But the problem is you're having to start up a whole process. That's kind of expensive. So you might say, if a process is too much, maybe I could start up one request to one thread. So this is saying, instead of starting up a whole process, I just want to start up a thread. The key difference between a process and a thread is all the threads share memory. Each process logically has its own copy of memory. So you'd say getting rid of the step of having to duplicate memory, even logically, can save you time. But each one is running as its own independently schedulable thing. In other words, each thread will still be able to execute its code concurrently. And when each thread ends, it takes care of it. But now, the problem here is, again, threads are still relatively expensive. Maintain that, and if you constantly create and destroy threads, that adds up. So instead of that, you might say, well, let me go to thread pools. So we So that means I pre-spawn so many threads, so like 20 threads, and then as requests come in, I give them to the threads that already exist, and say, oh, you get that one, you get that one, you get that one, and as they become available, they can say, oh, that thread's available, now you have. So instead of saying a new person is created for every request, you just reuse the one that you have. This is better, but it's still not that cheap. It's not the fastest way of doing it. The fastest way of doing it is the way Node does it. And the way you do it is by making all I/O asynchronous. Now, this is where things get a little weird. Now, when we say we want to have these different schedulable things, the idea is that this one, let's say we have one request that's asking for a large file. So that request is asking for a large file. Say, I want to download something that's a gig in size. So now, one thread or one process is busy sending that file. And it's going to have to sit there and wait while it gets downloaded, while it goes through the networking side. And then there'll be other requests. There'll be other threads dealing with other requests for shorter things. Oh, that's only 1K in size. Oh, that's just 5K. So we'll just keep sending those off while this one thread keeps running for a long time while it transfers, say, the virtual machine image that I just gave you for the class. But why did the thread who is sending the file, sending that big file, why can't it do anything else? It's spending all of its time waiting. What it's doing is it's taking a chunk of data, sending it on the network, and then waiting for it to be received. And then when it gets acknowledgement that's been sent, it then sends some more data, and then waits. Most of the time, it's waiting. So if most of the time it's waiting, why does it require this whole separate thing? Why can't we merge those together? And that, in fact, is what Node is. Node actually consists of just one process, just one thread. It doesn't multiply. tracks. It's single-threaded. You can extend it with other threads. There's packages and stuff. But by default, it's running one thread of execution, one process. But it handles many requests per second because it never waits on I.O. Whenever you start a request, if you start sending the file, it'll send that request off, and then it will go do something else. And that's what I mean by asynchronous design, is that you never wait on I.O. You start an operation, and then you go do something else. And when that operation is finished, you're informed. And then you handle it then. And you keep, and so you can, in fact, be doing many things at once when those other things are tasks you have to wait on. Yes, sir. Promises related to this. The form of asynchrony that we're going to be talking about is callbacks. Promises is a refinement of it that has certain syntactic and semantic benefits, but it's also got certain complexities. And I don't think I'm going to cover promises in this class because we'll probably be too confusing. But we will be covering, and the particular form of this asynchronous interaction we're covering is something called callbacks. And that will be for next time.